Hello, and welcome to Baltic Ways, a podcast bringing you interviews and insights from the world of Baltic studies. I'm your host, Dr. Indre Ekmanis. And today, we listen to a discussion I had with Dr. Dotsa Dzinovska in February. Dr. Dzinovska is Associate Professor of the Anthropology of Migration at the University of Oxford. She speaks to us about the changing relationships between people, places, and the state in post-Soviet and modern-day Latvia, including the impacts of EU tolerance promotion projects and the paradox of Europeanness, as well as the effects of mobility and migration today. Stay tuned. Dr. Dzinovska, thank you for joining me on the podcast. Perhaps we can start with you telling us about the political liberalism that emerged as post-Soviet states transformed from socialist to capitalist and liberal forms of society in the 1990s, in particular in the context of your award-winning book, which received the AABS Book Prize in 2020, titled The School of Europeanness, Tolerance and Other Lessons in Political Liberalism in Latvia.
Yeah, thank you for that. I'm really honored by the prize and really thank you very much to the Baltic Studies Association for the recognition. The book looks at sort of really two kind of large objects of analysis, which are related. And one of them is something that I refer to as the paradox of Europeanness, which is best characterized as the need to draw a variety of boundaries around liberal democratic states, polities, and selves, while emphasizing the virtues of inclusion, openness, and tolerance. And this is something that is evident, for example, in bordering practices when borders need to be securitized, but border crossers treated in a civilized manner. So it's this sort of, again, the kind of coexistence of both inclusion and exclusion. It's also evident in how exclusion works, for example, in the name of inclusion. And indeed, I think this paradox is most visible in places that are either being transformed to become European or are striving themselves to become European, as was in Latvia and in the Baltics in 1990s and 2000s. And often this constitutive contradiction of Europeanness gets spatially displaced. So, for example, Eastern Europe perceived to be more exclusionary and Western Europe more inclusionary, but sort of, you know, this looking at this from the places that are in the process of becoming European, this becomes more visible, this kind of constitutive contradiction of Europeanness. And this also relates to my interest in something that I refer to as actually existing post-Cold War liberalism, because what happened in the Baltics and in Latvia in the name of liberalism, in the context of tolerance promotion, when that term was used kind of routinely to suggest that what the Latvian society lacked was something like liberal sensibility, is not the same as late 19th century liberalism or liberal theory. It's actually quite a different formation. So my book really was about trying to map it. What is it? What is actually done and required in the name of liberalism? And so the book began as an investigation of tolerance promotion, of how kind of a group of people tried to convince the Latvian public that there was a widespread problem of intolerance in the Latvian society, and then to reorient public attitudes towards embracing this virtue of tolerance. But as I looked deeper into this, I realized that tolerance promotion really was one element of a much bigger project of transformation, which was rather comprehensive, that really required a remaking of how people individually and collectively imagined, described, and enacted their place in the world and their relations with others. And so then I went to kind of, from tolerance promotion, went to different sites of where this took place, such as borders, such as sort of relate to how people relate understandings and relations with history, minority, majority relations, and other key sites that I saw at the time as, you know, being kind of these sites where these dynamics played out.
Yeah, you mentioned history as one of these sites. And of course, this is part of the discourse today as well. And I wonder if you can tell us more about how you used understandings of history in your work to examine European tolerance promotion. You know, I'm thinking perhaps about your example of Duke Jacob, who, for context, is the Baltic German Duke of Courland, who had colonial ambitions in Tobago and the Gambia in the mid-1600s.
What I was interested in was to sort of map a little bit how understanding and relating to history can become a civilizational project, bracketing for a moment, kind of trying to establish how things really were and who has kind of the right historical sensibility. I looked at it in relation to several cases, and one was the sort of perhaps for many it might seem marginal, amusing, but I thought it was quite an interesting lens, the kind of the appearance of the colonial pursuits of Duke Jacob in Latvian self-narrative as a nation, even in actually school textbooks, which I didn't include in my book, but should have really looked at, you know, how it appears in school books. So I was interested in this both. On the one hand, why is it mobilized and to what end, but also why does it kind of invite such puzzlement and the need of explanation by, let's say, let's call them for a moment, liberal observers. And to me, it was precisely this crucial moment for thinking about what Europeanness means, and Europeanness increasingly, of course, today means knowing how to relate to something like colonial history correctly. And which, of course, those Latvians invoking Duke Jacob and his colonial territories demonstrated their inability to do so, that they didn't know how one is supposed to relate to colonial history. And so then that was kind of one terrain of re-education of how this is to take place. And the same with, you know, how does one think about these kind of late 30s, how race and eugenics were treated. And a lot of the times I saw, instead of really attempts to understand the relational histories of those formations, rather kind of attempts to invite or make, or however we want to describe that form of agency, Latvians to kind of correctly relate to those moments. So for example, Germany could claim that it has already done it, and then therefore could become a kind of almost like an instruction, you know, an instructional manual, how to do this, how to correctly relate to this kind of history. So that's what was interesting to me. And I didn't necessarily go into parsing out exactly what happened and so forth. So I was able to point to these historical scenes as scenes where contemporary politics and contemporary forms of becoming were fought out or negotiated.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about the kind of European convergence for Latvia and the Baltic countries. And one question that comes up often in kind of transatlantic discourse is whether or not the Baltic states were sort of fated to become part of these Western institutions. And I wonder if you might sort of speak to the geopolitics of it all.
To me, what was interesting is sort of what I might called geopolitical overdetermination of the field of action, or even sort of the discursive field of possibilities in Latvia and in the Baltics, where perhaps certain courses of action were not even allowed as possible because of a very, very sort of clear orientation westward and clear orientation towards joining institutions for security concerns. I was struck quite recently, actually, when new political forces appeared several years ago before the last parliamentary elections, and looking at economic and foreign policy programs of these political parties, and they had very little to say, because it seemed that those questions, foreign policy and economic policy, were almost taken out of the national debate, because of course they will align with those of the larger institutional structures of which Latvia is a part. So to me, that is, well, that is politically problematic, but also in terms of actually what it shows about, as again, about these forms of power that operate in Latvia and the Baltics. And when we think about this actually existing forms of political liberalism, what I find to be really interesting is that given this geopolitical situation and the proximity of Russia, and Russia completely explicitly and more so being perceived as the prime threat to something called the international liberal order, that allows also, of course, shapes the domestic political terrain in Latvia, and now allows for the situation where, for example, while the sort of self-proclaimed liberals, people concerned with minority rights, might criticize Latvian nationalists for exhibiting unpalatable attitudes towards these minorities, the same nationalists could actually claim
to be defenders of the international liberal order vis-a-vis their policies towards Russia. So there are different kind of scales or levels of liberalism that can be played against each other, really given the geopolitical situation and proximity to Russia. And not only the fact that Russia is perceived as primary threat to Latvian security, but also increasingly as the prime threat to something referred to as the international liberal order.
Yes, certainly. I wonder if we can perhaps turn now to migration, a sort of emigration or depopulation crisis that Latvia has experienced. And I'm thinking about your work exploring the concept of leaving as a form of staying and emptiness in the Latvian countryside. And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about these concepts in your work.
Yeah, my turn to migration follows really on the heels of the book on political liberalism, because while my interlocutors at the time, whom I refer to as tolerance workers in the book, were very much preparing society for immigration and trying to convince the public that we need to be open towards migration, that tolerant attitudes towards migrants is a kind of a hallmark of Europeanness, which of course was all questioned in 2015 in the context of migration crisis. Many of the kind of the target audiences of these tolerance workers were saying, but what about all these people leaving? As the kind of the political liberals were concerned about attitudes towards immigration, they sort of seemed to overlook at the same time that actually more and more people were leaving, and that very little concern was kind of voiced about that in the public and political space. And indeed, in the kind of early years of what then came to be referred to as the Great Departure, there was more talk of emigres as somehow betraying the nation and kind of not being able to craft the kind of good life, you know, that they'd like to leave, and that's, you know, kind of easy way out leaving. And then I think fairly quickly thereafter, the state realized that if this kind of attitude continues, then about one third, if not more, of the population might be lost forever. And that is, of course, exactly the national people that are needed to legitimate the national state. So there, again, the kind of political and economic forms of power intersect, and I think in really interesting ways. And the staying as leaving or leaving as staying, what I tried to argue by using that formulation is that I thought there were too many studies in Eastern Europe, more broadly, not just in the Baltics, of emigration or migration that used Albert Hirschman's exit voice and loyalty framework. We wrote it in the context of corporations, and then was transferred to the nation state context. And in a kind of a globalizing world where forms of power such as sovereignty and capital really work across territorial borders and in a way reconfigure the sort of the nation state model, they don't undo it, but they do certainly reconfigure it, that it was not very useful to think of movement in relation to nation states as the kind of the seats of power, that power needed to be reconceptualized a little bit to understand what was actually happening, what were people doing when they were either staying or leaving. So in that sense, what I meant by saying that leaving is a form of staying is that those who were leaving, they were seeking a particular kind of model of life or flow of time, as it were, where, you know, good job leads to better wages, to then better apartment or and so forth and so on. So a kind of linearity of progression of betterment of life that they thought was available to people in the UK and so forth. So they were seeking what they understood to be a good life. And good life proceeded in these kind of moved forward. Whereas in fact, what we're also seeing is that actually new forms of capitalism are perhaps eroding that kind of flow of life, not just in Eastern Europe or post-socialist context, but, you know, in Western liberal democracies as well, with deindustrialization, post-Fordism, and so on. So leaving as a form of staying is this kind of an attempt to hold on to an old model of good life by moving in space. So you're kind of actually staying in the past, as it were, while leaving in space. So that was the idea there. And that really, the idea was there to kind of rethink, re-territorialize power, how we think about power, and that one should not judge mobility only in relation to the nation state, but rather in relation to trans-border forms of power. So that's sort of the one story about migration. And the other story that you asked about is the one that I've referred to as emptying or emptiness. And what I mean by that, and of course, it's a controversial way of speaking about this in a way, is because often talk of the emptiness or emptying of the countryside is perceived by liberal elites as a kind of populist move. But for me, it's very much actually the language that I encountered through my ethnography that locals used to describe the radical changes in their life worlds and in the space around them. Even though they didn't like external representations of their living spaces as empty and abandoned and sort of this aestheticization of decay, they did use those terms to describe in very textured ways what was happening. So as an anthropologist, that's, you know, that's one way to approach my work, is to stay very close to the ethnography and try to conceptualize it, recognizing all the potential traps, but working through them and really trying to make sense of what is this emptying, you know, for the people that are actually living it, and how do they make sense of it? And what do we see again about these broader forms of, or larger forms of power when we look through this very specific lens of the emptying countryside?
You describe that idea of emptiness, the way that it is aestheticized for an outside observer through the lens of a photographer. And I can read the quote here, that one international news agency photographer mused, "The morning cup of coffee is still sitting on the table and the stove is still warm." This idea of immediate abandonment, mm-hmm. which is quite powerful, but then kind of conflicts with the way that people want to see themselves. And even if they're describing the same sort of emptiness in a different sort of sense.
Yeah. And again, it's just an opens up to different methodologies, right? I mean, if you are driving through, or if you are a photographer, or if you are a journalist and you go to a place like that and you kind of capture the snapshot of it as you pass through, and especially places which are entirely abandoned. And for example, in Russia, there are really, you know, in villages and in Latgal as well, that there's nobody left and then the houses are just standing empty. And you take a snapshot of it and you can capture it, and then sort of it becomes an aesthetic kind of representation of this. But what it actually means to live there day in and day out, of observing the changes in the environment, of trying to tackle various kind of government problems. What does it, you know, mean to kind of actually govern a village where 80% of the houses are falling apart? It's a different challenge for the government than, let's say, one of development. And I, for a long time, I haven't really heard the term development in some of the places that I work in. People just kind of throw up their arms and say, what? I mean, there's still enough room in the cemetery. What development are you talking about?
Wow. Yeah, that is quite striking. You know, part of the emptying of rural areas in Latvia is also this movement toward northern England, you know, once made possible by the European Union and now kind of complicated by the implementation of Brexit and changing citizenships. And certainly the Latvian state has made these sort of efforts to retain or reclaim this population, to ensure their sense of nationality and belonging. And I wonder if you can speak to that and, you know, thinking about our current moment, what the impacts of the pandemic might be.
One of the disciplinary peculiarities of anthropology is not to anticipate perhaps or speculate that much about what's to come, and rather perhaps turn the tables and think ethnographically about such anticipations, about what people's hopes, aspirations, and desires are in such situations, and what do they attach to and why. So if we sort of start from what you ended with, COVID in particular, it was, of course, very striking for me to see the circulation of images of empty global cities, of the capitals, you know, of major European nations, from Paris to Barcelona and then onward to, you know, New York and so forth. This sort of urban emptiness that was very quickly interpreted by a particular segment of the global public as potentially a manifestation of degrowth of the kind that we really need to sort of save ourselves from ourselves in the sense of environmental issues. And that perhaps this urban emptiness, you know, yes, on the one hand was linked with people going indoors, but only a particular set of people because others are actually stayed on the streets for they either not had no homes to go to or were actually expelled from the cities, as we saw in the case of India in the early months of the pandemic. And, you know, some, in other words, were driven indoors and others potentially went to the countryside where they had second homes or actually tried to buy houses or obtain other forms of, you know, accommodation in the countryside. And for a moment, I mean, that also seemed to be the case. There were various ways to measure this. You can measure it by mobile phone activity, where actually people are in the given time, or, you know, real estate agencies chipped in and started saying, oh, well, actually, there's increased interest in those particular properties. In Latvia, for example, one real estate agent told me that she had what's called illiquid properties on the market for 3 years, sort of rural houses that were maybe in the kind of the range of 15,000 euros. And suddenly they were all gone in 3 months because people realized this. So a lot of this has more to do with really the hopes and desires of a particular segment of the population rather than lasting reality. It's really too early to tell whether any of these are lasting practices. And from what I can tell, at least in my fieldwork sites, as one interlocutor yesterday, in fact, we were talking about it, put it, that those who have stable jobs and families, so the kind of the good, let's say, workers that are have gone abroad, did not come back, could not come back, or had to stay in their places of residence and continue working in one form or another. So the kind of, let's say, the solid middle class, right? Not the kind of upper middle class like myself, who was able to. Actually, I'm in Riga. Well, actually, right now I'm in Latgale, but generally speaking in Riga, because I was able to move. Nothing changed. I can teach online. And of course, I'm one of the privileged few. So the solid middle class sort of stayed where they were. And then, again, as put by my interlocutor yesterday, this sort of, in Latvian, there's a kind of term, plana, galdiņa, urbe, or I don't know how to kind of translate it into English, but those who are not quite, who move around like drifters, let's say, right, who work 3 months in Norway, 3 months in the UK and so forth, they did come back because, of course, that form of mobility and labor is now no longer possible. So they're sitting it through here, but not being particularly productive, as it were. And again, this is one representation, you know, of I'm also trying to kind of gather data in real time. So we don't really know what the tendencies are. It's more likely that people have these kind of, they have established for themselves a circuit that they can move through depending on the situation. Most have two homes, or most of those who work obviously in the UK or elsewhere have some kind of a home to return to if need be, but it doesn't mean that they do or will. And so it's really a kind of, the jury's still out, as it were, on what actually is going to happen. I don't expect there to be a significant revival as a result of COVID of the Latvian countryside, for example. With Brexit, of course, it's slightly different story, but Brexit now seems so long ago, I have to say, with the pandemic, that I can barely remember what that is. But again, I think, yeah, dual citizenship, there people are, again, what we could sort of, if we look from the perspective of the mobile subjects, people are assembling their packages of statehood and sovereignty. They are able to not concentrate all their relationships with an entity called the state in one place. They might exercise their kind of sovereign relations whereby, you know, they need to for there to be a territorial Latvian state in order for them to feel like they are mature political subjects and subjects of a state that is actual, of a nation that has a state. So they're very invested in the political sovereignty and territorial sovereignty of the Latvian state, but they're not that invested in it as a kind of a caretaking state. So they take, you know, those kind of relations with the state, they take to other territories. And I think that's increasingly going to be the case, where people simply assemble packages of statehood by distributing across territory various state relations.
Yeah, I find that idea of assembling your statehood really fascinating. For example, in the context of Baltic immigrant populations during and after World War II, and then after the reestablishment of independence, where these national communities in the diaspora have a very strong investment in the existence of states, but have also assembled all of these other trappings of citizenship that better align with their day-to-day life. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I want to thank you so much for your time. It was great, great to have this conversation with you.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm really honored to be on this emerging podcast.
Thanks so much.
Paldies, noteikti. Labi, nu tad jau gan jau ceram sastikšanos arī citos kontekstos.
Yeah. Thank you for tuning in to Baltic Ways, a podcast from the Association for the Advancement of Baltic Studies, produced in partnership with the Baltic Initiative at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. A note that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the authors and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AABS or FPRI. I'm your host, Dr. Indra Ekmanis. Subscribe to our newsletters at aabs-balticstudies.org and fpri.org/baltic-initiative for more from the world of Baltic studies. Thanks for listening. See you next time.